Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Francois Peretti. How are you, Francois?
Very well, Chris.
Excellent. And you're from the Champagne Information Bureau in London here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm the director of the Champagne Information Bureau in the UK.
Perfect. Luckily, because we're going to be talking about champagne today. We're going to talk a wee bit about just an overview of champagne, because it's a wine that we've talked about a lot about sparkling wines on the show, but we've never actually spoken about champagne. So just in a nutshell, what is champagne?
Well, champagne is the best sparkling wine in the world. As simple as that.
So it's a sparkling wine, and it's made to the traditional method. And where is it based in France? I imagine most people...
Well, champagne only comes from Champagne. And the Champagne is 120 kilometers, you know, northeast of Paris.
Mm-hmm. So it's quite close to Paris. And that was the original market for champagne, wasn't it? In the old day, you know, long before sparkling wine was created, champagne was actually known for making, what was it, white wines or rosé?
Well, champagne, if you go back, you know, to ancient times, you know, there was vine, you know, and there were vines all over Champagne, just like today. Mm. The wines that were produced, you know, were quite different from the wines we have and enjoy today. But yes, you had, you know, still wines. You still have still wines, you know, in Champagne today. Very, very small production, but
oh, really?
You can still find them. They're not under the name Champagne, obviously, because yep. Champagne only is only Champagne, but they're called, you know, Coteaux Champenois, and they come, you know, in white or red. So it's a minute production that is usually, you know, enjoyed in the region.
Yeah. And what sort of grapes do they use for those?
Well, they use exactly the same grape as are used, you know, for champagne, because in the region, you know, you only have, you know, those grapes. So they are two, you know, red grapes, black grapes, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and one white, which is the Chardonnay.
And there's still other grapes allowed to be used in champagne, aren't there? But they're not allowed to be planted or something like that.
Yes, it's not so much that they're not allowed. Yes, I mean, historically, the wines of champagne were produced, you know, with, I think, six or seven different types, you know, of grapes. Mm-hmm. The reason why I think that they became less used is that empirically, you know, people have tested and tried, you know, which grapes among, you know, the ones that they had were best at producing champagne. And the producers, you know, decided that Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier and Chardonnay were the best grapes.
Okay. And I heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I use it in my tastings actually as a quiz question. What was champagne famous for before it became famous for sparkling wine? Do you know what it is?
I have no idea, but I guess you're going to tell me.
Wool.
Wool.
Wool. Before sparkling wines, champagne was quite famous for making wool.
Well, wool was, because champagne was on the, you have Troyes. Troyes was one of the big centers of the wool trade, which was not necessarily because, you know, they had wool that they grew and in the region. It's simply because the wool trade, especially in the Middle Ages, came from Italy. And, you know, the route, you know, was Italy, Lyon, and then they went up to Troyes. So there was a big, you know, wool trade.
Oh, okay.
Which it's not because they grew, you know, actual wool like in, you know, South or Dakota or Carolina or, you know, wherever.
New Zealand,
you know, not exactly. And you had lots of sheep that they used, you know.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
I always thought that I just imagined these fields of sheep, actually. But no, okay, so it was a trading hub.
Yes, it was the trading. And Troyes, which is one of our most, you know, gorgeous medieval towns in France, because, you know, in France, we don't have many medieval towns left.
Mm.
Like, you know, in other countries in Europe, if you go to Italy, you still have it, in Spain, etc. Not so much in France. So Troyes is a gorgeously preserved medieval town, and it is one of the centers of the big markets, you know, the medieval markets.
Excellent. All right. So when did champagne start to become like a sparkling wine, because obviously they were making wines before then, but you know, this is all about the sparkling wines of Champagne. So when did it really start to become a sparkling wine?
Well, you always had sparkling wines in the region, simply because even before the second fermentation was discovered and mastered, which is much later, the wines of Champagne underwent, like any other wine, a first fermentation. And what would happen is that, you know, the wines would be kept, you know, in the cellars, and the weather would get colder and the fermentation would slow down, and the weather would get warmer and the fermentation would naturally start again.
Yep.
So effervescence in Champagne goes back a very, very long time. But if we go to the definition of what Champagne is today, modern Champagne is a sparkling wine that has undergone a second fermentation within its bottle.
Yep.
The bottle it is sold in. So the second fermentation has to be induced. And also, the second half of what Champagne is must be produced, you know, in the Champagne region, exclusively in the Champagne region in France. So if we go back to the first component of what makes Champagne, Champagne as we know it today really starts, you know, when the second fermentation is induced. And that is, you know, a sort of improvement on natural effervescence.
Yeah. The old effervescence in a bottle was a bit of a problem back then, because of the glass technology wasn't quite up to standard. And if you did get that second fermentation, you could lose lots and lots of bottles of wine, which...
Yes, they used to call it, you know, the devil's wine, because, you know, they felt that they did not understand why the bottles, you know, would explode in the cellars. And not only they lost a lot of bottles and wine, but also it scared them, you know, quite significantly.
Yeah. But I think, a gunshot, isn't it?
Yeah, it must have been, you know, quite scary. But I think that, you know, we can thank the British, and especially British bottle makers, you know, for, I mean, they can be credited for discovering and much stronger glass that at the time, especially I think it was in the 18th century, you know, could sustain the pressure of, you know, the sparkle and the effervescence.
Yep.
And the British along the, you know, I mean, I feel a bit British somewhere, you know, having been here for over 20 years. I hope the British won't mind. But I think that the British contributions to modern Champagne, you know, is, you know, are quite, you know, significant.
Yeah. We've done shows in the past talking about Christopher Merritt and the Coopers adding molasses and sugar to make the wine sparkly. So deliberately doing that fermentation in the past. So I don't really want to cover it here. Probably the most important part that I thought in the sort of history of Champagne was Madame Clicquot's discovery of riddling, or getting rid of that dead yeast out of the bottom.
Champagne was never discovered. You know, when people say to me, you know, who discovered Champagne? I said, no one discovered Champagne. It is a succession of not discoveries, but contributions, of observations. And, you know, the riddling, the second fermentation, the technology as we know it today, you know, all lead, you know, from those observations. And of course, you know, great improvements and, you know, steps, you know, in Champagne production.
Do you know when they started removing the dead yeast, when that was sort of first started as a part of the process?
I don't know the exact date, no.
Okay.
I mean, what we know about the dead yeast is that because we have paintings and we also have glasses. So we know that in the 18th century, they must have been drinking champagne that was pretty cloudy, because they actually had the pomponne, you know, their glasses did not have a foot. The glass was footless, and they drank it and put it back on a little sort of plate, because they got rid of the sediments which were in the glass.
Oh,
that
really?
Way. So we know, you know, pretty cloudy.
Okay. Now, what is Champagne? Is it a department? Is it a region? Because a lot of French wine regions seem to be broken down by department. But I don't think of Champagne as a department.
It's a region.
How does it fit within the hierarchy of France? You know, because France has departments, don't they?
Yes, but the département, you have several départements, you know, in the Champagne region.
Okay.
So département is a much smaller, but here we're talking about, you know, this is the Champagne region, which is much broader than the département. I need to double check, but I think you've got three départements in the region.
Okay, so Champagne actually is a region that encompasses multiple administrative areas.
Correct.
Okay, and I originally thought that Champagne was the name of the soils, like in Cognac. They produce fine Champagne Cognac, and the reference to the Champagne there is reference to the soils, which are the same soils as in Champagne. Is that how you understood the name came about?
No, it's not exactly how, you know, the word Champagne can only be used in Champagne. It refers...
And Cognac.
No, I'm coming back to that. The only region that still uses... is Cognac, and it does not refer to the soil. It's simply because Champagne comes from the Latin campagna that meant, you know, flat soil, meant la campagne, which is the rural area in Latin.
Oh, okay.
So historically, the Cognacais have been using fine Champagne. It's the only region outside the Champagne region that uses the word Champagne is the Cognacais, as you mentioned, because they mention Grande and Petite Champagne. It doesn't mean that the soils are similar, because they're not. It means that it comes from the same etymological word, which is the root, which is Campania, the Latin Campania, that means, you know, rural flatlands. And that's the only reason.
Just if you're wondering why the police thing.
It's not for us.
It's not for
it's
us.
It's not for us. It's not for Chris.
We're recording.
We haven't called the police to take him away.
We're recording this on the corner of Earl's Court and the A4, and it's quite a busy road. I think there's a highway for the policemen. And how come they were allowed to keep the name? Because everywhere else, pretty much everywhere except for parts of America, which make traditional champagnes, which I love, everybody else has sort of been... sort of banned or you know, had their arm twisted behind their back to not use the term. But in Cognac, they haven't had their arm twisted too far. So what's going on there? Is there pressure to stop
them? We have to ask them.
Okay. You don't know why, or?
We have to ask the Cognacais.
I'm surprised, because the EU gets quite, nickety about that sort of stuff. You know, they've made everybody like Tokaj and Alsace had to change because it might be confused with a Hungarian Tokaj and all sorts of stuff. So I've just thought that was quite interesting. A little bit of inconsistency there by the rule makers in the EU. But you've
got to ask Brussels.
Okay, now that's cool. All right, so we've sort of talked a wee bit about the history. Is it's not really an invention, it's more of an evolutionary process. And then I think the last step was the use of the muzzle on the top. I heard they used to use rags and all sorts of stuff to try and keep the wine in, but that wouldn't have kept the bubbles in. Have you heard much about the old stoppers before cork?
Yes, I think, of course, I think it was not only rags, it was, there were wooden pegs wrapped in cloth.
Oh, okay.
I think, you know, they were just trying, and then you had probably sort of sort of natural straw to hold it. Must have been, you know, quite a production. It's a bit easier today.
Yeah,
and okay. A bit more scientific.
And a bit more interesting with the tops. Have you heard of the term? How's this one for you? This will throw you. Plaxomusophile.
No, tell me about it.
I'd never heard of it either. Plaxomusophile is the term used for someone who collects the tops of the champagne. You know those,
the very tops that have
absolutely. Really beautiful pictures in them and all sorts of stuff. And some people collect them.
Yes, I know. So that's their names.
And plaxomusophile, it sounds like some sort of terrible disease, but I had a lady do a presentation to me once about it. And I've always thought that was quite interesting.
Yes.
And do you know the reason why some people put so much effort into it? And some of them are even got the image on the inside, so you can't even see it on the bottle.
Yeah. Well, I think it's all part of the individuality of Champagne. You know, a lot of there's a lot of individualism, you know, in the Champagne region, and I think it's the way historically that people, you know, want to talk about their history.
Let's talk a wee bit about the method of production. You know, we've been talking a bit about the evolution of the production, but Champagne is one of the few regions that are allowed to make rosé wine by adding red wine in. I thought it was hilarious about 2 years ago, the EU said, oh, we're going to allow everybody to make red wine by adding white and red, and everybody got an up in arms about this being the most appalling thing ever, and then not many people in Champagne make rosé wines by leaving the juice in contact with the skins. There are a couple of producers, I understand, but...
Well, there are quite a few. But I think that both methods of producing rosé are now, you know, totally accepted in the Champagne region. I think at the end of the day, it depends what you are looking for. Both methods are widely accepted, and it very much depends, you know, what you are looking for. And, you know, with the skin contact method, you know, you can end up with red champagne, for instance, which is not allowed in Champagne. If you were to produce a red champagne in Champagne, you'd have, you know, it wouldn't be called champagne. Mm-hmm. So I think that the other method is probably more reliable in terms of color. And of course, you know, the degree of color very much gives you an indication of the taste, the flavors of
Does
the
it?
Pink. Of course. The darker it is, the more fruitful it will be, the more fruity it will be, the more full-bodied it will be, simply because you will have left, you know, the skins, you know, on in contact, you know, with the wine, you know, much longer. That's how you produce, as you know, red wine.
Yeah. So you'll get more
fruit if you just give a little tinge of pink, you know. I mean, I think this is the beauty of pink champagne, because you have a wide variety of champagne anyway. And this is also reflected in the pink category, where you can have, you know, I mean, consumers have different tastes. You have consumers who love, you know, drinking champagne, just pink champagne, because it's got a nice little color, but they're not crazy about, you know, fruity or full-bodied champagne. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have people who will actually go for a very full-bodied vintage rosé, which can go very well even with, you know, pheasant or capon, or, you know, white meat, but some, you know, fairly richer, you know, type of meat.
Okay, then I think we're going to wrap it up there, Françoise, and we'll come back to this next week.